Are unmarried women bringing the country down or helping it rise up? Rebecca Traister will be here to talk about Rise of the Single Ladies.
Across classes, across races, across the country, the marriage pattern is altered, and we haven't really considered how this changes expectations and scope for adult American women.
How do you play every single character in David Copperfield? Actor Richard Armitage will join us to talk about his narration of Dickens' most beloved novel.
Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anyone else, these pages must show.
What makes listening to music different in the digital age? Ben Ratliff will be here to talk about his new book, Every Song Ever.
The listener has new power, accesses power. All of a sudden, listeners are more powerful. What are we going to do with that power? And how might we use it to listen more broadly instead of going down a bottomless comfort zone?
Alexander Alter will give us an update from the publishing world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Rebecca Traister is here to talk about her new book, All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women and the Rise of an Independent Nation.
I am so happy to be here.
So I've got to ask the very basic question, why did you decide to write this book?
Well, the origin story of how I decided to write the book is that it came about in the weeks and months before I was going to get married, and I was 35. And I didn't have any ambivalence about getting married. I didn't even feel like it was that big a deal that I was getting married. I wasn't having a giant wedding. I wasn't, you know, but just in the logistical lead up. And it was so strange to me at 35 years old that I was going to be doing this. It seemed pretty improbable, in part because I had identified for so long as single. This transition into, wow, not only have I fallen in love, which was the big transition for me that happened, you know, when I was 32, 33, but I'm going to get married, mm-hmm. You know? It made me think about it.
You were going to cross over to the other side.
I was going to cross over to the other side. But, and also I couldn't help but think about what a different role this institution was going to play in my life than it had, for instance, in my mother's, right? Which I think is this certain life milestones make you do comparisons to, you know, those who've come before you, parents or grandparents. And my mother, who had a very robust career as an academic, got a PhD and worked as an English professor and, you know, was one of the first women in her department, had this groundbreaking career. She had been married at 21, like days after she graduated from college. Mm-hmm. You know, she had gone from her parents' house to college to a home that she shared with my father. And so all of her growth, educationally, professionally, socially, the, you know, formation of friendships and living in a new city and building one's career was all done alongside my father. And they have a very happy marriage and have been married for 50 years. But it was so different from what my experience was, which is I had made my home in the world. I had built my career. The summer that I was getting married was actually the same summer I was about to have my first book published on women in politics in the 2008 election. I had this really strong network of friends. I just had a really kind of firmed up adulthood. Mm-hmm. And marriage was a wonderful thing. And my husband is wonderful. The particular marriage I was going to embark on, I was thrilled about. But it was just such a different role. I didn't want to write a book about myself. And I just thought, we don't have enough recognition of this, not just a new stage, but actually a whole new map for what female adulthood in this country so often looks like now, across classes, across races, across the country. The marriage pattern is altered, and we haven't really considered how this changes expectations and scope for adult American women.
I'm not going to ask you this question because I can't stand this question, but I am certain that you've either gotten it before or will get it at some point while touring for this book, which is just out this week. And that question is, how can you write about this if you're not single? And I wonder if you have anything to say about that, because it seems like that's a question that women will often get when writing a journalistic or nonfiction book about something that isn't necessarily reflective of their own experience.
Still to this day, I'm 40 now. I've spent 5 years as a married person and 15, you know, so far my adulthood is still dominated by the experience of being single in terms of the amount of years I lived it. Secondly, it really did mark me as somebody who felt particularly single. Thirdly, it was something I feel like is a really important story about the country, mm-hmm. and about the story of women's move toward greater equality throughout the history of the United States. And damned if I wasn't going to write it just because I was married, right? So that's the practical answer. But there's a bigger answer too, which is that the book isn't, and it's pretty clear, that it's not simply about comparing these two states, like mm-hmm. married life or single life. That one of the things that happens when you lift the early marital model, mm-hmm. which is the one that dominated women's lives for generations and for centuries, where because women had much less ability to be economically, sexually, professionally, publicly liberated and independent, for generations, they were dependent on marriage as the thing that kicked off their adulthood, which gave them any kind of economic stability and the ability to have families and a sex life without fear of social censure. Women really did have to enter marriage at the beginning of their adulthood, and they were so often defined by their marriages. For economic reasons, for social reasons, for sexual reasons, for all kinds of reasons. And marital law for a long time, which was taken from English common law of coverture, really meant that wives legally were covered by their husbands' identities. They didn't have their ability to keep their own money. I mean, wives did on individual circumstances, but and exerted lots of agency despite rules of coverture, but there was a loss of identity. The man's identity covered the woman's, and it had to. This was the highway that we sort of hustled most women down for a long time. Once you remove that model, it's not just that you get some alternate in which, oh, now everybody's unmarried. What mm-hmm. you get is a variety of paths, right? And those paths can wind around marriage, both straight and gay, mm-hmm. cohabitation, years spent single, years in and out of monogamous relationships, years with, you know, a variety of sexual partners, years of celibacy. And many of our lives now include many stages in all different, and parenthood inside of marriage, outside of marriage, divorce. You know, many of our lives now include all those things in different sequences, and there are just so many more paths available to women mm-hmm. That they may take without fear of becoming social outcasts.
Part of this rests on the, you know, the demographic shift towards later marriage, and I think that you have the age of first marriage for women is now...
It's over 27 nationally, but in many cities it's over 30.
Okay, and I know that charts divides according to race, according to socioeconomic status. Mm-hmm. But I just want to talk a little bit of this outside of gender for a second, because that's true also for men,
yes.
right? And
mm-hmm.
how much of this is part of the overall kind of delaying of adulthood, this whole transition to adulthood, adolescence phenomenon?
Two parts of that question. The first is it is true for men. So there are many more single men and many more men staying single longer than ever before. This book doesn't center men's stories.
That's the next book.
Well, there may be people writing these books right now, because it's a really crucial part of the story that the book doesn't tackle at great length. But in part, the reason why is because it was always, historically, it's always been more possible for men to live outside of marriage. So even though they're doing so in more numbers, and it certainly is altering the shape of men's adulthood as well, it's not a revolutionary rupture in what's possible for them. Mm-hmm. Whereas for women, it's really like a whole new frontier of being able to live as a valid, independent adult more easily in the world. And that is a social, political, economic, sexual revolution. The second part of your question, there has been all this discussion of how this extended period of unmarried life, mm-hmm. You know, now presumed, even if you just take that median age that was for 100 years, as long as they kept track of it until 1980, the median age of first marriage for women was always below 22. It only fluctuated between 20 and 22, between 1890 and 1980. Between 1980 and now, it has gone to 27. So that is a massive jump just from the median age mm-hmm. of like a chunk of 20s spent outside of marriage. It has coincided with the development. Lots of social scientists talk about extended adolescence. Adolescence is one thing that people talk about. And I think that's interesting that people are thinking about it as a life stage that we haven't previously identified, akin to the way people started to think about middle age or adolescence. And that's pretty interesting. However, the pop culture depictions of unmarried life, especially for women, mm-hmm. I feel, are so tinged with the implication that there is an immaturity about it.
Yep.
That it's you're not adult, particularly that you're selfish, because in one way or another, you are presumed to be putting your own desires, whether it's the desire to pursue your own career goals, to make money. We often associate it in pop culture privileged realms with acquisition, like to buy stuff for yourself,
right.
to get your nails done, and that's selfish and it's immature and it's
buying
childlike.
Buying jewelry for yourself.
Right, buying jewelry for yourself. You know, if you want to have a liberated sex life and not be bound to one partner and experiment, we see that as sort of selfish, and there are all kinds of nasty sexual implications. I think this is actually a very twisted view of single life as opposed to married life for women, which is rooted in some very old attitudes we have about women and how they're fundamentally still not supposed to put their own selves and their own desires first, and that we very easily denigrate them when we do. Because the interesting thing about single life, and I actually lived this myself, single life is very much real life. Mm-hmm. Whether it extends to your 25 or to your 35 or for your entire life, single life is a world in which you are presumably earning, mm-hmm. doing your own domestic work, feeding yourself, fixing your own bookcases, screwing in your own light bulbs, you know, shoveling your own snow, going to the office, getting your own coffee in the morning, paying your own cable bill, in many, many cases, raising your children on right. your own. This is very real life, and it is very real adult life. And one of the things that happened to me when I married in my 30s is that my life got appreciably easier because there was somebody with whom to split the load.
Right.
And the idea that that life that I lived as a single person, which was more selfish, but was somehow more immature, makes no sense to me. And the one other thing I want to say on that is that for generations, we have had a category of adult who has... We assume to live a life in which that adult is cooked for, cleaned for, and children are taken care for. And those are husbands,
yeah.
right? And we never think of the scourge of, you know, immature husbands.
Right.
But in fact, the traditional way that it's worked is that husbands have been cared for as if they were cared for by their mothers deep into adulthood for their entire lives. But we've never sort of written them off as immature.
There was an argument in the late 90s and sort of turn of the last century, I hate using that phrase, but that was coming from the right in general and from women on the right, which was that by marrying later and having children later, women were interrupting their career paths and their sort of path to economic security and success, and that what women should in fact do is marry, you know, right out of college and then get all of that baby stuff out of the way and then move on to their careers.
Yeah, that's not true. Again, this is about the variety of options and a variety of paths, and
right.
that may work very well for some people, and there are certainly advantages to it, I say, as a lady who just had a baby at 40 and I'm very tired. However, if you're talking about economic and professional advancement,
mm-hmm.
one of the things that has been demonstrated, so women continue to pay professional and wage tolls for both marriage and having babies,
right.
and men continue to get bumps in their
right.
professional status and their earnings mm-hmm. from getting married and having babies, okay? So there actually was an incredible study from, I believe, 2013 that found that delaying marriage for women into your 30s results in an $18,000 bump for women who have graduated from college. And for women who have not graduated from college, delaying marriage into your 30s actually, even in that situation, results in a $4,000 bump. For men, it is the reverse. Getting married early gets them more money and later does not. I mean, there's sort of a pretty well-established benefit to women if those tolls that you're paying for marriage and motherhood come at the beginning of your career when you're just getting established. It is much harder to get back into that track, especially when then you have the children during your 20s and your
right.
30s who still are requiring your time and labor. One of the reasons that we've seen the delay of childbirth in particular is, and this is something, though the changed marriage patterns aren't a self-consciously politicized thing, there are very few women who are saying, I'm not getting married because I don't believe in marriage or because I want to be a liberated person.
Right.
You know, that's not what is motivating this. However, there are an awful lot of women who will tell you when they're young, I gotta put my career first. There's a kind of instinctive knowledge that developing a stronger professional and economic base is going to better protect you against the disruption of parenthood and marriage later in your career.
How much is delayed marriage a choice? And how much of it is circumstance? I mean, is it harder to get married?
It's fascinating, the language of choice around it, right? Because for many of us who have lived it, many who are still living it, it does not feel at all like a choice. It's like, I would love to fall in love. I would love to get married. Whatever form that human impulse toward partnership, toward love, toward sex, toward a kind of a purportedly permanent bond with somebody is, you know, it doesn't feel at all like a choice. But here is what the choice is that is new and revolutionary. what many people will say is, I haven't met the person, right? It's so hard to meet a person with whom you want to live every day, with whom you want to have and raise children, if that's something that you wind up doing or want to do. The difference and the choice is that if you haven't met the right person now, you don't have to marry somebody who's not right.
Right.
And that, for years, when there was less possibility for economic stability and independence for women, when there was less of a possibility to have a liberated sexual life, a liberated romantic life, a liberated social life, that was not the case. You might not have met the right person. I'm of the school that it was probably always really hard to meet the right person, but that marriage meant something different in different eras. And so even if you hadn't met the right person, you married a person because you needed a paycheck.
I want to ask you one other question, because you did a ton of research for the book, both in terms of the academic research and interviews. What was the most interesting interview you did?
In a chapter that I was writing about female friendship and how foundational women's friendships with each other and platonic friendships with men are outside of marriage, and how, in fact, those friendships often play the roles that marriages have historically in many ways, or that we imagine marriages to have played. I interview a pair of friends, Amina So and Anne Friedman, and about their relationship and the strength and importance of the relationship. And in separate interviews, they both spoke from different angles about how they'd been the people to work out each other's health insurance plans with.
In sickness and in health,
and
yeah.
Yeah. Often, even when we do talk about the power of friendship, we do talk about it emotionally. She's my soul sister. We know each other. We identify, whatever. And sometimes it's about, like, who helps you choose your health plan? That basic thing that we think of as spousal or familial.
Who picks you up from the hospital?
Who picks you up from the hospital? Who unbuttons your dress? Which is a story that Anne tells in the book about being in an urgent care center, you know, her shoulder's thrown out of whack, and she can't unbutton her dress when she goes home at night, and she longs for her friend or for somebody to be there to unbutton the dress. And it's our friends who are often playing those dull but intimate roles for each other.
So it's the single women, but together.
Yes.
All right, Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rebecca Traister's new book is All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation. Alexandra Alter joins us now with news from the publishing world. Alexandra, hi.
Hi, Pamela.
So there was a big merger this week.
Yes, there was a large acquisition, and it was one that devoted followers of Publishing News were probably familiar with already. Hachette Book Group bought the publishing arm of Perseus. Hachette had made an earlier bid 18 months ago to buy Perseus, but at that point, the deal didn't last. It was a little too complicated. Hachette was trying to buy all of Perseus, including its distribution business and its publishing business, with a plan to sell the distribution business to Ingram. So now that they have come to terms again, the deal this time is that Hachette is buying Perseus's publishing arm only, which includes 9 imprints. Meanwhile, Perseus has sold the distribution business to Ingram Content Group, which is one of the largest distribution companies in the country. And so this is another, you know, what's interesting about this happening now is we've seen these massive mergers and acquisitions in publishing in recent years. Penguin Random House is, of course, the biggest one. That made, like, this behemoth with 250 imprints that puts out, you know, more than 10,000 books a year, maybe 15,000.
What percent of the market are they?
I think they have 25% of the market.
Mm-hmm. And then there are
more than twice as big as their next largest company.
Because it's the big five, right? So
exactly. There's 5 now. There used to be 6. And, you know, the News Corporation bought Harlequin. Hachette itself has been trying to grow its publishing footprint in the United States. They're part of a French conglomerate. So they picked up Hyperion. They picked up Black Dog and Leventhal all in recent years. And so when you see something like this happen, it's another sign that to kind of compete and survive today, publishers really need to be big. They need to have the big blockbuster hits to kind of keep afloat, but they also need these diverse kind of lists of nonfiction, you know, niche kind of books like health and wellness and travel. So when I spoke to Michael Piech, who's the chief executive of Hachette Book Group, he said basically this company has 90% of their lists are nonfiction. We're not that strong in nonfiction. We don't have any travel books. This is a way to sort of diversify what we're offering and sort of give us a stable base of backlist books, things that will sell kind of no matter what, and so they won't be as dependent on blockbuster hits, which,
right,
you know, Hachette Books at the moment sort of is. They have these big authors like James Patterson, Michael Connelly, Donna Tartt, But if you have an off year and you don't have two or three of those books,
right,
you know, you're sort of struggling.
So it's balancing the front list and the back list.
Exactly. So I talked to, you know, a couple analysts about this, and one of them, Mike Shapskin, said he expects that 10 years from now there'll be two big commercial houses. Right now there are five. So he expects to see far more consolidation.
Wow.
And, of course, another reason that these companies want to be big is to negotiate with Amazon or even Barnes & Noble.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a giant list and a lot of best-selling authors, it gives you a little more leverage with big retailers.
So it's now Perseus Books, which is Basic Books, DeCapo Press, Avalon, Nation Books, a few others. Now it will be owned by Hachette Book Group, which includes Little Brown. What else is in Hachette? Grand Central?
Yeah, Little Brown, Grand Central.
Hyperion, which is the grown-up version of Disney's former publishing arm.
And when you look at kind of who they have these huge sellers, like Twilight is a Hachette book, you know, because they have their YA list. So.
Right. Okay, well, I guess big news in the publishing world. Thanks so much, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Ben Ratliff joins us now to talk about his new book, Every Song Ever, 20 Ways to Listen in an Age of Musical Plenty. Ben, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So listeners of the podcast, in addition to our podcast, will be familiar with Ben, who is our, what is your title, chief?
Oh, I'm not chief anything.
You're not chief anything.
No.
What is your title?
I'm a jazz and pop critic at the New York Times.
And you've been doing this for a long time.
I've been at the Times for 20 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And this is your fourth book. But
true.
Your other books were very specifically about jazz.
They were about jazz.
How is this book different?
Well, this book is about listening to music in general, and specifically listening now. Now meaning this moment when we can reach in our pockets and have immediate access to an astonishing amount of music really quickly. It's not actually every song ever, as the title says, but it can seem that way. It can seem that way to me every time, every day, really, when I look on one of the streaming services. And for professional reasons, just as a reference to check out something, I'm amazed at how much is out there, how deep it is. So the question is, okay, let's think about this. Let's mark this moment. We didn't used to have everything. We do now. The listener has new power, accesses power. All of a sudden, listeners are more powerful. What are we going to do with that power? And how might we use it to listen more broadly instead of kind of going down a bottomless comfort zone.
And for you, this is, I mean, writing a little bit more broadly as well, right? Because you're not writing just about pop and jazz.
Right.
Was writing this book, was that part of the interest or attraction for you in terms of writing about other genre of music?
Completely. At the paper, I have written a lot about jazz, but, you know, really what my job is writing about everything that isn't classical music, because we have great classical music critics here, and that's their ballpark. But, you know, I mean, within the course of a week or a couple of weeks, I might write about a band that was important in Rio de Janeiro in the early 60s. And then a couple nights later, I might write about a new R&B singer. And then a couple nights later, a jazz musician who was, you know, his first record was in 1993. I don't know. It's all over the place. And more, after spending so much time doing that job, I started to see music as just a huge totality. And whatever it is that I'm writing about, how can I approach it best, most directly? And for me, that always came down to matters of sound. You know, I'm a listener. Here's the music. What is this experience? What am I experiencing? I guess I extrapolated from that to write this book. And it's sort of like an old-fashioned music appreciation book, the kind that would teach you how to understand music better, how to enjoy it better. You know, in the old days, it might break down music into categories like this is harmony and this is rhythm, and, you know. But I'm breaking it down into categories based on listening experiences. So in my book, one chapter will be about listening to repetition, and another will be about listening to slowness or listening to density. And within each chapter, I try to have examples of really far apart examples of music. The other thing about the book, which is kind of tacit is that it's an argument against genre.
I was going to say, this is about you writing about other genre, but also about the current landscape kind of transcending genre.
I think genre is really useful for selling. I like tradition, by the way. I really like tradition, and I think it's different from genre. And I think those two ideas get confused a lot. I think tradition in music, inherent to that idea of tradition, is an idea of growth and change through time. And genre feels to me inherent in that term is an idea of sort of like reduction mm-hmm. and something static. So I just feel like genre is for selling, tradition is for growing. This is not a book about a canon of music, like, you know, a selected number of great works. It's a book that's trying to give people a vocabulary to make connections between all kinds of music, which is what we can do now really easily.
Well, it's interesting because something similar is going on in the literary world where there's a breaking down of genre and a combining of genre and people rejecting even the idea of genre. I wonder if you think those two things are connected.
It could be, yeah. I actually notice it like a microcosm of this might be the criticism category of the National Book Critics Circle Awards.
Mm-hmm.
A book of poetry, basically, was considered in that category mm-hmm. last time around. And the notion of what criticism is has really expanded, which I think is great, which I love.
In the past, I know you've cited a film critic as your favorite critic, the film critic Manny Farber as a primary model. And I'm curious if you see sort of differences between what literary critics do and what music critics do or what film critics do, or if the commonalities are more important.
Yeah, well, they've all got different tasks, you know. Music critics, describing sound is really weird, you know, because it's always running away from you. It's in motion. Very subjective, actually.
Well, also, I mean, in a book review, right, we can cite the writing. You can
That's
see
right.
the writing on the page.
That's right.
But you're trying to describe something that I guess now, because of all of these digital advances, it's easier for people to then, you know, to go in and sample and listen to what you're describing. But you're essentially describing something that people are not experiencing.
Yeah. There's an academic style of music criticism or musical analysis where you can point to something in the score. That's not what we do at a general readership place like the New York Times. But also the way listening has developed through social media, like for instance, when you listen to a song on SoundCloud, as the song unfolds on the screen, you see people inserting little comments along the way. In a way, that's similar. That's mm-hmm. a kind of criticism. It's a kind of participatory listening where people might add a comment just at one minute and 32 seconds into some song, and they will write like, ooh, you know.
Right.
I love that, actually. But anyway, what I do as a music critic is everybody's got a different style. I always instinctively go to music sort of sound first. What is going on in the sound? What is the information that this sound is proposing? And then everything else second. The coding, the meaning, the political implications, how this song sits within the discography of said artist, whatever.
Is it difficult to find the language to describe sound for you? Does that come naturally? Are there cliches that you try to avoid too, the way that literary critics try to avoid certain?
Most definitely. Yeah. And the cliches, some of the cliches were, you know, started by some of the great writers, too. So that can be a problem. You want to imitate the greats, well, when you're young.
Right.
You want to imitate the greats. But also
now they can imitate you.
Yeah, yeah. But you have to know enough not to be embarrassing about it, you know.
What are some of, like, the terrible cliches of musical criticism? I know I'm getting a little bit away from the topic of your book, but—
Seminal.
Okay.
Yes.
Do not use—
No. Coruscating. that's probably another kind of
criticism. It's like
the
lyrical of music criticism.
Yeah. Well, we have that word too.
Compelling.
Oh, don't get me started. It's almost as bad as relatable.
You divide the book, as you mentioned earlier, into really interesting categories, repetition, speed. Let's talk about slowness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have a sample of music that you write about when you talk about slowness. Maybe we can listen to that.
Why don't we listen to just a little bit of that? It's Sarah Vaughan singing the song Lover Man from a record called Swingin' Easy.
I don't know why, but I'm feeling so sad. I long to try something I've never had. Never had no kissing. Oh, what I've been missing. Love a man, oh, where can you be?
In this book, I write about slowness as an experience. As a musician, when you slow down the tempo of a song to slower than it needs to be, it's very powerful. It intensifies whatever was there to an even greater degree. As a listener, when you're listening to something as slow as that dramatically slow Sarah Vaughan thing, it makes you think about, like, where are you taking me? Where is this going? What is this about? Am I ever going to get out of this? This could go on forever. And you start to think about life and death, really. And also, I think you accommodate the song as a listener. You sort of slow yourself down in order to hear it. You bring yourself down to a tempo of sort of like taking in life in the most wide-angle view possible, all that sort of stuff. So I write about that song in the slow chapter in the company of other pieces of music by Shostakovich and DJ Screw and Sleep, the doom metal band. All these people are doing amazing work with slow music.
The jacket copy on your book starts with this really intriguing and very huge question, and I imagine you use the entire book to answer it, which is, what does it mean to listen to music in the digital era? And I assume that's what a lot of this book is about. How has your listening experience changed in the digital era when you think back to even working as a critic at the Times and what that meant 20 years ago versus what it is today?
Mm-hmm. It's probably the same as a lot of people. We often are confronted with something that we've never heard of before. How could this be? Wow, I just heard a song that blew my mind, and nobody has ever alerted me to this composer or this artist before. All right, so what do you do? In the old days, that story would take, 5 years maybe. You'd start visiting record stores or you'd start asking people, Now you go online and you see it. It's all there. You've got the entire discography. You can probably listen to, you can skip through it all very quickly. You can sort of trace the outlines of this person's work. Maybe take it all in and sort of, binge style, or just know that it's there. You've got the rest of your life to take it in. So that's one way that my listening habits have changed. I absorb way more information much quicker.
I have to say, I like the downloading of lyrics just to be able to know, to no longer have to guess at what the words are to a song and just having that immediate access.
Yeah, and also to see them annotated on various sites, phrase by phrase, word by word. I mean, this book is also, it's not all about platforms. I think some people see the title and the subtitle and think, oh, this is going to be a book about Spotify and Pandora and, ways to listen now. It's not. But it is sort of suggested by the current situation where many of us listen to music on a daily basis through a streaming service, whether we're paying for it or not. And that streaming service is getting more and more sophisticated at trying to understand what you like and what your tastes are. I think many of us are beginning to depend on that, which I totally understand how that works from a business position. But my feeling is that listening is really creative. It's a really creative act for all of us. And listening to music helps us figure out who we are. It helps us determine what our relationships with other people are going to be like, how we move and dress. And I mean, it's very important. So to kind of give the reins over to algorithms who are reducing us to sort of listener profiles, I think that's a little worrisome.
Same thing is happening in books.
Yeah,
and
right.
in news.
Sure.
But yes, yeah.
Yeah, if you like X, you'll like Y.
Right.
It's correct some of the time, but some of the time it's not. And it's based on a much more reduced version of you.
So oddly, it ends up narrowing in a certain way your field of
right.
exposure.
Right.
Ben Ratliff, thank you so much. For listeners who are familiar with Terry Castle, I would recommend her essay that includes Ben Ratliff in it. I think she calls you scarily knowledgeable. Is that right?
Something like that.
But it was good.
Really
it was
nice.
Good. All right, Ben, thank you again.
Thanks. Thank you.
Ben's new book is called Every Song Ever, 20 Ways to Listen in an Age of Musical Plenty. Richard Armitage joins us now. He is an actor and, most recently, the narrator of a new Audible version of Charles Dickinson's David Copperfield. And here's Richard Armitage doing the opening lines of David Copperfield.
Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anyone else, these pages must show. To begin my life with the beginning of my life, I record that I was born, as I have been informed and believe, on a Friday at 12 o'clock at night. It was remarked that the clock began to strike and I began to cry simultaneously. In consideration of the day and hour of my birth, it was declared by the nurse and by some sage women in the neighborhood who had taken a lively interest in me several months before there was any possibility of our becoming personally acquainted, first, that I was destined to be unlucky in life, and secondly, that I was privileged to see ghosts and spirits. Both these gifts, inevitably attaching as they believed to all unlucky infants of either gender, born towards the small hours on a Friday night.
Richard, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Pamela. How are you doing?
I'm good. So this is not your first audiobook. How did you get into literary narration?
I've been doing audiobooks for some time now. It's more recently been working with Audible, but I did work with Naxos a few years ago. And I think the first one that I ever tackled was in conjunction with a television series I'd done, Robin Hood, when I was asked to read some of the stories in audiobook form. And I jumped on the opportunity because I was in the middle of shooting it, and I was able to basically do little impressions of all the actors that I was working with, which I found highly amusing. But I just really enjoy the format, and I enjoy being alone with a microphone and having no other tricks up my sleeve other than just my voice.
But I would think as an actor, doing a role both on television and then an audiobook would be a particular challenge because you've already conceived of the role and I would imagine relied on certain physical attributes, which you then don't have when you're doing the audio version.
Yes, and you know the thing is with those audiobooks, The world was already created for me by the production design. And often, for example, I then read some Georgette Heyer, which was a world that I didn't know very well. That period of time isn't familiar to me. So I was really relying on her writing to stimulate my visual imagination. And then I proceed to describe what I'm seeing in my mind. Dickens is slightly different because I'd read a lot of Dickens through my youth, but then I was in a stage production of David Copperfield, which strangely didn't really influence the what I was visualizing as I read this particular book, but certainly voices and performances of my friends that I was on stage with have kind of remained in the back of my mind as sort of echoes.
And who did you play in that production?
I played Uriah Heep, which was sort of unlikely casting for me. I don't think I matched him physically, but it was a great challenge, and it was the first time I'd really made a kind of transformation of my body and my voice in theater. I sort of revisited Uriah in both in the audiobook, but also in a recent television series which I did. I played Francis Dolarhyde in Hannibal, and I think there were echoes of Uriah Heep in Francis Dolehide. It's so interesting how these threads sort of link to other characters that you play. But so of course I came to the David Copperfield audiobook having recently played Francis Dolehide. So I think there were little connections.
I'll also have to throw in, just because you mentioned the art of physical transformation, that you did, of course, play Thorin Oakenshield in the Hobbit movies, which as someone who's 6'2", you also had to do a little bit of transforming to get into dwarf-like shape.
That's very true. I mean, that's something which, again, is, you know, that's in the hands of the CGI and the filmmaker. But were I to voice Thorin Oakenshield in an audiobook form, I think I would probably be using the same voice that I used on screen. I don't think I'd be trying to make him sound smaller.
But it's interesting because, you know, one thing that The Hobbit has in common with David Copperfield is that these are books that are both incredibly beloved and also books that people tend to read at a relatively young, impressionable age, and have very sort of, you know, beloved formative experiences and impressions of these characters. Is that intimidating to take those kind of roles on?
You know what? Not really. It was not something that I'd considered. I mean, I was given a choice of books, but I picked David Copperfield because I think there is a perception of the Victorian novelist, which is a sort of slightly stuffy, stifled, overly verbose writing style, which I wanted to sort of, you know, break out of. Mm-hmm. And I know that David Copperfield was written in first person as a diary form. I just thought that's a perfect opportunity to read the voice of the character and the author in the same book. And, you know, Dickens' humor and his observation of his society that he was living in, particularly the legal system that he was working in, I just thought there was something relevant about it. But at the same time, it was an amazing story.
Did you read Bleak House as well, sort of in preparation for the narration?
I have read Bleak House a while ago, but I didn't touch on it for this. I just really focused on the 1,000+ pages of David Copperfield just for this one. But yeah, it was surprising to me when it came out at 36 hours. I thought maybe I should have read a little faster. But you know, it takes the time that it takes, and
right.
That's one of the wonderful things about Audible and the way that they present their product is that you can take as long as you want to listen to this. And, you know, I never expect people to listen to it in one sitting. You know, mm-hmm. It can take them weeks and they can come back chapter by chapter. And it's up to me to sort of keep them with the story. So hopefully we achieved that.
What was the preparation like?
You know, you read the book as quickly as you can because there is a, you know, there is a fairly limited amount of time before you can go in there. So reading the book and really just making a list of every single character that you're going to voice and providing them with an identifiable voice, which is different to everybody else, so that we know who we're listening to when we come back to them. Because that's one of Dickens' traits as well, is that he'll introduce a character in chapter one and then they won't come back until chapter, you know, 15 or something. You have to be very specific about the quality of the voice. And often Dickens' description of character gives you that window into who they are and what they sound like. And I have to do it without too much judgment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Although the Murdstones were quite difficult to sort of empathize with and make them sound like good, decent people, because I did have a judgment on those two characters. I didn't see them as particularly benevolent, so you create a voice for them which is reflective of that, but at the same time trying to make them human rather than just villainous. But it's as simple as that. And often I mark up the pages so that the sentences, which are extremely long and that can ramble a little bit if you don't have a clear kind of destination in mind, and you provide yourself with little stepping stones so that you can make sense of those long Victorian sentences.
Did you have to, you know, go back and listen to your own recordings of characters that, you know, that you hadn't visited in a number of chapters to think, you know, how did Mr. Micawber sound? How did I do that character?
When I first started doing audiobooks, I would have a list on the wall beside me of the quality of the voice, and I'd usually write three words to describe what the voice sounded like, whether it was a regional accent, the tone of the voice, the timbre of the voice. But I don't need to do that anymore because the technicians in the editing suite have this amazing ability. The first time you speak as that character, they will take a little sound bite and pop it in a list themselves so that on chapter 26, I can say to them, how did Mr. McCorber sound? And they'll play me back.
Oh, wow.
A little version of that character. But what's interesting, as you go along, sometimes a character can bed in and really develop. So then I would request that I go back to the beginning of where the character first arrives and revoice that, because the voice has slightly changed or has become, you know, a bit more kind of in my body. So there is the opportunity to do that on a digital recording as well.
That's kind of disappointing because I wanted to hear what your three-word descriptions of were of, you know, Mr. Micawber and Uriah Heep. And
I think Uriah was Delcy, wiry, and whiny.
Did the way you played his character change from when you had first done that character on stage?
Yeah, again, interestingly, I thought that Uriah would be the easiest character for me to voice when doing the audiobook and the most satisfying because I played him. But what I realized was that when I played him on stage, it was a very physical manifestation of a man because Dickens describes his body movements very mm-hmm. clearly. And in the audio studio, you have to sit very still. And of course, I started writhing around and so they're on the microphone saying, I'm sorry, you have to sit still. We can hear you moving. And I was like, well, I can't do this voice without kind of writhing and talking, you know, making him kind of, what's the word, to sort of grind himself physically. So it was less satisfying than I thought it was going to be. But, you know, that's part of the challenge, is a lot of these characters that Dickens creates are so physically described that keeping still in the studio so that you don't get ambient sound and creating that voice is one of the challenges.
Well, who was your favorite character to play in the narration?
I had a few, actually. One of them that I really amused myself with was Miss Moucher, because it had taken me by surprise a little bit. I think I'd forgotten about her. And then when it came to reading it, I just threw something in off the top of my head.
Can you give us a little bit of it?
She's kind of from Liverpool. She talks like this. She's got a really high little voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who I'd based it on. I think there was a famous British drag act called Lily Savage. I think there was a little bit of him, her in my head, and something else. I can't remember, but she's tiny as well, and she has to hop up and down on tables. So it was a little bit of an emergency voice, but in the end, it sort of worked out kind of quite funny and amusing because she speaks so quickly, and she's kind of a wounded little thing. But I enjoyed her a lot.
Before I let you go, if you had sort of one dream novel that you could narrate the audiobook version of, what would it be?
I think I'd really like to have a crack at Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. That's one of the books that was the first time I'd really read something as an adult, which was very much tied into where I was going as an actor. I was just about to start drama school, and it was stimulating a darker side of my imagination. Normally I read for escape and for fantasy, and this was really kind of tapping into sort of the dark side of my personality and the things that I was interested in exploring, you know. So Crime and Punishment led on to a fascination with Macbeth, and actually all of the characters that I've, or many of the characters that I've played in my career, I think started with the fascination with Raskolnikov. So yeah, that would be something I'd like to read.
All right. Well, let's hope some audiobook publishing casting person is listening. Richard, thank you so much.
Thanks. Nice to talk to you.
You too. That was Richard Armitage. He is the narrator of a new version of David Copperfield from Audible. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
It looks like we don't have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, standard over on the fiction side, there are three new titles, much lighter in nonfiction this week where there's just one new title. But I will start with the hardcover fiction list, where the first new title is down at number 15 by a woman named V.E. Schwab. That's V for Victoria. She used to write young adult fiction and recently has started writing adult fantasy novels. This book, A Gathering of Shadows, new at number 15, is a sequel to an earlier book called A Darker Shade of Magic, which did not hit the list. This may be the first time that she's hit the adult hardcover fiction list. That's new at number 15, A Gathering of Shadows. Then at number 7, somebody who is not at all new to the list, Joanne Fluke, continues her series of kind of baking murder mysteries with a book called Wedding Cake Murder. I've talked about her on the podcast before. She does something funny. All of her titles take a tasty dessert treat, red velvet cupcakes, in this case, wedding cake, and follow it with the word murder. So it's this...
Is there a funnel cake murder?
Not yet, but if she's listening. She writes about a small town Minnesota baker who keeps kind of stumbling across corpses and being called on as an amateur sleuth to solve the mystery. In this case, the wedding cake in question is her own. She gets married, but before she does, she has to solve the murder of a visiting chef to town.
I feel like if she's on social media, she should ask her readers, like, what baked good would you like next?
Yeah, maybe we'll get Rugula murder next.
All right. Greg's nomination.
And then finally, new at number 2 this week, also not a newcomer to the list, Debbie McComber, who's been writing for 35 years and has frequently hit the list with series. She's also got kind of small town Midwest series going, often about knitting or about religious faith. She's got a series of books about angels. She often writes Christmas novels. This one is sort of a standalone, although she's calling it part of her New Beginnings series. It's a book called A Girl's Guide to Moving On. That's about a woman and her mother-in-law who are both going through divorces at the same time, and they're becoming closer through the experience. That's new at number 2.
Divorced together.
Yes.
All right. On nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side, the only new title is new at number 3. It is Playing to the Edge by the former CIA director Michael Hayden, who was in charge of the CIA during the whole post 9/11 war on terror, when waterboarding became a big issue, and just other CIA tactics in general were very much in question. Here he is writing a book that comes to his own defense and the defense of the agency.
And that was reviewed last week in the book review by Peter Singer. All right, that's it.
Yeah, that's it.
All right, thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.